This is the Making Good Podcast, episode 46. Welcome to the Making Good Podcast with me, Jen Gale. Stay tuned for inspirational stories from ethical and social entrepreneurs and people making good stuff happen in their communities, as well as tips, tools, and techniques to help you grow your ethical business and amplify your impact. Hello, hello. Welcome to the Making Good Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in and for joining me. And today I'm so excited to be sharing this interview with you. And I know I say I'm so excited every time I publish an interview, but this interview feels like it's been a long time coming. I first met Corinne back in May 2017, so earlier on this year, and we've been trying to arrange a time to get together to have a chat ever since. But I just knew as soon as I met Corinne that she would be an amazing guest, and the passion and enthusiasm and energy that she has for what she's doing is just phenomenal. So here's a little intro for you. The Real Junk Food Project is an idea that was started by one man, a guy called Adam Smith, who's a chef, and he set up in December 2013 in Arnley in Leeds, what was a food waste cafe, a pop-up food waste cafe, I think. But it's grown into a whole movement, a global organic network of pay-as-you-feel concepts. And we discuss in the interview what pay-as-you-feel means and quite how it works. And the projects divert surplus edible food that's destined for waste. And they make it, I think the phrase on their website is, they make it accessible for human consumption, which sounds a bit odd, but basically they make delicious meals out of it and make them available to everyone. They have a mission or a manifesto, which is to feed bellies, not bins. And I absolutely love that. And there are now over 100 projects all over the world. So in this episode, I'm chatting to Corinne Bell, who's the founder of Real Junk Food Manchester. And as I said, I met Corinne earlier this year, when I was speaking at an event in Manchester. When Corinne heard about what Adam was doing in Leeds, she was really excited by the idea and went over to meet him to find out more. And the rest, as they say, is history. And Corinne set up the first Real Junk Food Project away from Leeds. And not only that, they've set up the first junk food restaurant right in the centre of Manchester. Corinne's passion and enthusiasm and her desire to do what's right is so evident in this chat and is so evident to anybody who speaks to her. And it's really inspiring to hear her talk about the very real changes that she is making, both locally on the ground and also on a much wider scale too. I was really inspired by meeting Corinne earlier on this year and by our chat, and I know that you will be too. Enjoy. Hi Corinne, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hello.
I'm so excited to have you here. I say every week I'm so excited to have the people here, but I really am, because we've been trying to set this up for ages, haven't we? And I've got so many questions I want to ask you. So can you start off by introducing yourself and telling us what you do?
Yeah, my name is Corinne Bell, and I'm one of the directors and the founder of an organisation called Real Junk Food Manchester. And what we do is we source food that would otherwise go to waste. We cook it up into absolutely beautiful dishes, and we serve those dishes to anyone and everyone on a pay-as-you-feel basis.
I absolutely, and you've just like said that really succinctly and quickly, and it makes it sound really easy.
But I've said it a lot.
Yeah, I bet you've got your elevator pitch nailed down, which is perfect. So what's your background? How did you end up doing what you're doing now?
There's a professional background and a personal background mm-hmm. to it, I guess. Firstly, I was raised by a Stockport household with Irish roots mm-hmm. Where nothing was ever thrown away.
Yeah.
My dad was a bricklayer all his working life, and we constantly had a garden that looked like a builder's merchant. He used to, you know, if there were chimney pots or railway sleepers or, you know, even nice, you know, really good bricks that he knew were a, you know, particular color or particular style, they would just come home and then they'd go out on the next job. So I think that has been a big influence.
Yeah.
And then on the professional side, I worked for Manchester City Council for a number of years in homelessness and then in housing standards and then in environmental strategy and policy. And I spent a really interesting chunk of time between 2009 and 2011 working in environmental strategy and policy when Manchester was writing its first climate change action plan.
Okay.
Which was a really, an incredibly interesting project. I'm really public facing. I'm really proud of the way that was delivered. Because it wasn't Manchester City Council will write a strategy that will sit on a shelf. It was Manchester as a city, get the universities involved, get the big businesses involved, get the campaigning organisations involved, get the Friends of Parks groups involved, everyone and wow. anyone as a stakeholder in sustainability in Manchester. And then the government changed in 2010
yeah.
and we got that first, I'm really trying not to swear now, we got the first delightful coalition government.
Yeah.
And Manchester City Council lost £109 million from its budget in 1 year.
Yeah.
And they were giving out voluntary redundancy. And I just thought, well, my role has always been really public facing. I know an awful lot of the, you know, groups, organizations, businesses, community groups involved in sustainability. So at the beginning of 2011, I took voluntary redundancy and went freelance. And ended up working with lots and lots of big and small local and national charities, community organisations, sustainability groups, campaigning organisations. And as I'm sure you do the same in any sector you're working, you just spend half your life networking,
yeah.
chatting to different people from different organisations, what works, what doesn't, what's new, what's going on. And at the... I'm trying to think when it would have been, sort of beginning of 2014, I guess, someone told me about this guy called Adam Smith, who'd started this thing in Leeds called the Real Junk Food Project. It sounded really interesting. And I phoned Adam, made an appointment to go and see him and just spent a couple of hours just sitting with Adam and chatting about the model and how it had developed and using wasted food and the legal implications, the food safety implications and pay as you feel as a model and what he was trying to do. And I just loved it. I just loved it's doing a lot of environmental good. It's doing a lot of social good and it just feels right. Mm-hmm. It just feels like what should happen. You know, there's food going to waste and there are people out there that can't afford a hot meal, but more than that, it's bringing people from different backgrounds together, which yeah. feels really important at the moment.
Yes.
And I haven't had a day off since.
Fabulous. So yeah. can you just give us a little bit of background around the Real Junk Food Project? And I know you can't speak for Adam, but do you know why it came about and how it's grown since then?
In terms of the Real Junk Food Project as a network, as a movement starting, I'm fairly certain that Adam is still completely bowled over by the response that he's had to his little crazy idea. Adam was a chef. He'd been a chef for, I think, about 10 or 12 years when he started Real Junk Food. And he's a working class lad from Armley in Leeds. And he was never academic. I think the last time he was in school, he was about 12 or 13.
Gosh.
But it turned out he was very good at cooking. And I can totally see why. I mean, he's utterly driven. But one of the nice things about the food and drink industry and professional cooking is that it's actually quite democratic. You don't have to be academic. You don't have to have family connections. In order to do really well at cooking, what you've got to be is very focused and willing to work incredibly hard and really interested in learning. And he's obsessive. So Adam had done very well at cooking and he'd found himself in a position of success that I think almost made him quite uncomfortable. You know, he's a working class lad from Leeds. He's working in some very high-end restaurants, making very fancy meals that created a lot of waste for people who didn't really appreciate them. And then going back to his hometown of Armley and seeing people who couldn't afford enough food, never mind and nice food and also social experience of getting out and being in something like a nice restaurant.
Yeah.
So Adam at a certain point got very stressed and had a very hard time and decided to stop working, went and did a bit of traveling with his partner at the time, found himself in Australia, and I think kind of thought maybe that that getting kind of back to nature and doing some volunteering on farms would calm him down.
Okay.
And then saw the level and scale of food waste on farms. And came back from Australia really determined to do something. Mm-hmm. And he found a premises that he could just, it was a community cafe that wasn't open full time. And he found a premises where he just go in, you know, said to the guys who were running the, it was a, I don't think it was Mind, the mental health charity, mm-hmm. but it was a similar sort of project, I think I'm right in saying. And they weren't open every day. So Adam just sort of said, well, can I go in one of the days when you're not open and just start cooking? And he just started cooking meals because he's got so many contacts in the restaurant industry, and the food industry and wholesalers. So he just started sourcing waste food, cooking meals and pay as you feel almost accidentally. I mean, we're certainly not the first people to do it, and he'd seen it other places, but pay as you feel, as we understand it, excuse me, sort of almost came from people going in, having a nice meal and saying to Adam, how much do I owe you? And kind of in a roundabout way saying, I don't really care.
Yeah.
Just do what you like. And pay as you feel kind of came from that. And Adam, I think he opened the cafe in December 2013. I went to see him in about March, I think, 2014. And loved the concert. I mean, it was just busy. It was constantly busy. It was buzzing. There were, you know, Armley is the area of Leeds where the prison is. There's a lot of hostels and halfway houses. So there's a lot of that, the dog end of the private sector, people who have refugee status, people who are on probation, people who have very limited access to funds or access to no funds. There's an awful lot of people in different situations who are struggling in that area. And it was just brilliant to see, you know, lots of people from lots of different backgrounds, lots of different languages being spoken, and lots of people just, unlike any other cafe you'd go to, people taking simultaneously the role of customer and then the role of cook or then the role of
server.
Or, you know, pay as you feel is about far more than money, and I love that about it too. So it was, you know, someone would sit, have a meal, be a customer for a bit, and then say, can I wash the pots for a bit? And I'd just go, yeah, sure, just get involved. And I, there was something about the casualness of it, the community feel of it, that was lovely. So I got in, so I sat, met with Adam, had a chat, and then a couple of days later sent him an email just saying, I really like the model. I've seen lots of different projects. I've seen things that work and things that don't. And I think it's got a brilliant feel to it. I'd love to bring it to Manchester. How would you feel about me starting something and calling it the Real Junk Food Project Manchester? I will totally understand if you want to keep that name for yourself. And he sent me an email back. I think I've still got it to this day, I think, that just said yes in capital letters with lots of exclamation marks, and now in capital letters with lots of exclamation marks after it. And it was just like, well, okay, I think that's permission. Right then, I'll do that.
Wow. And so now, how many, I don't know if you know off the top of your heads, how many Real Junk Food projects are there around the country?
Over 100 across the world.
Wow.
So there is, I mean, God, I think the vast majority of them are in the UK. I know there's, you know, just off the top of my head, Brighton, Bristol, Edinburgh, that just because Adam is there and he's prolific, I think is the word, well, mental is one word, prolific is another. I think there's about 30 different projects in Leeds and Yorkshire in, you know, in some form. Or another, Manchester, obviously, and Greater Manchester, we've got Oldham and Wigan have Real Junk Food projects. They spring up everywhere. And then there's one in Australia. There's one in, I think it's in Victoria in Australia. There's one in Israel, which is very exciting. There's one in Berlin. I'm trying to think where else. I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting about. But the, you know, the project seems to really inspire.
I was going to say, what do you think it is about it that people see it and they think, yes, I want that, and I can create that, I can make that happen?
I think there's something about it that, on a really felt sense, is just right. It's what should happen. There's a lot of projects out there that target people who are in food poverty, and they're essential, especially in this economy. And they're the difference between no food and some food for a lot of people. One of my issues with projects that target people in food poverty is, A, I think there's a danger if you're using waste food, that the message, if you're targeting people in food poverty, is that it's second-class food for second-class citizens, and that's not the point. The point is that this food is perfectly edible, that our food system is insane, that this food should never have gone to waste. I don't care if you're the queen, I don't care if you're homeless, I don't care if you're, you know, layer of wealth in between, this food is perfectly edible. And my other issue with projects that target people in food poverty is, if you target people in food poverty, what you also do is separate them from everybody else. And Adam is not a strategist. He wasn't, before he started the Real Junk Food Project, he wasn't deeply aware of sort of strategic issues around social integration or social isolation, economic segregation, but he just had a really wonderful felt sense of what's right. And the pay as you feel model, and just that idea that we're not targeting anyone, we're not excluding anyone, we're not separating anyone, just this is waste food, it's perfectly edible, our food system is bonkers, and we're just gonna feed bellies, not bins. And that's the mission, that's the tagline. Everybody's welcome. Pay whatever you can, pay whatever you like, donate your time, your energy, your skills, just get involved. And I think there's something about that that is just, anyone that hears it just goes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what should happen.
Yeah. And I think one of the things is, when you look at problems like our food system, and, you know, even if you scale it up, you know, the economic system and things like that, and people can see that it's broken and can see that it doesn't work, and like you said, it's bonkers, and all this food is perfectly edible food is going to waste, but it's such a big thing, it feels very, very hard to know what you can do about it. And I guess that the model provides people a very accessible, pleasurable way to be able to contribute to trying to fix it in some way.
Yeah, it's just beautifully practical. You know, if you want that, and I totally agree, we live so globally now, you know, you're constantly bombarded with news, and let's face it, most news these days is bad news. You watch the news and it's not a list of lovely things that have happened, because a general rule, is it? You just get bombarded with, you know, there's storms here, there's hurricanes there, there's war over here, there's famine there. And I think we are just exhausted. What we always try and do with any sort of messaging or campaigning is, yeah, we're talking about a really serious problem, but we're always talking about the solution. I think people get really burnt out by, you know, the world is too big, no matter what I do, everyone else is doing their bit. And if you can give people really simple, positive actions, all you have to do, if you want to feel better about yourself, you want to do good, something good for the environment and something good for your local community, is just come and eat with us instead of giving you money to, I won't mention a brand name.
A large brand, a large corporation. So the actual model, because you're the first Real Junk Food Project, am I right in saying, with your restaurant?
Yes, there's lots of other members of the Real Junk Food Network, and there's lots of other projects out there using waste food. As far as I know, and I keep prefacing that with as far as I know, because we've had a really good look, but I'm terrified that the first time that I start really confidently saying we are the UK's first waste food pay-as-you-feel restaurant, that someone will turn around and go, no, you're not. We've been here for years.
Yeah.
And I'll deserve it for being smug. But we've had a good look around. There are lots of projects in the network and lots of other projects who are working with waste food, who are doing community cafes. Mm-hmm. There's lots of projects run solely by volunteers who make meals. What we're trying to do, our version of this was, if we want to make something that's genuinely inclusive, then actually what you need to do is attract middle-class consumers who have disposable income mm-hmm. and consumer options. Because again, there's lots of projects out there that say everybody's welcome. There's lots of projects out there that say, you know, that there's no qualifiers. You don't have to demonstrate mm-hmm. that you're on benefits or demonstrate that you've no income. Mm-hmm. You can go and get a free breakfast, a free meal, but they're not places that people who have disposable income want to go to, or they're not places where people who have disposable income feel welcome. Yeah. Because the point is that, you know, someone's put funding behind that and it's for people who are in food poverty. And if you've got money, you don't want to take away from that. But again, we're segregating people based on economic status. So the idea, and it's taken us a lot longer than we intended to realise this, but the idea was always to create a really cool city centre venue with a consistently great food offer, restaurant quality dishes, and then just say, and by the way, all of this is made using 100% wasted food, and all of it served on a pay-as-you-feel basis, and everybody's welcome.
And you started off with a pop-up model, didn't you?
Yes. We started off in middle of 2014 as just a bunch of volunteers, a small group of people trying to see what was possible. Mm-hmm. Started doing some pop-up events, more along the lines of what the other groups were doing, you know, kind of community events and pop-ups using solely volunteers.
Yeah.
And then at the beginning of 2016, we, after having a bit of a think about it and thinking about what we wanted to do, we hired two professional chefs. We were incredibly lucky that it happened that at the time we were looking for a chef, Mary Ellen McTague, who is an absolutely astounding award-winning chef and has represented the Northwest on Great British Menu twice, was looking for something different to do. He was looking for a new challenge. So God knows how this happened. Sometimes the universe is just quite nice. But we ended up with a multi-award winning celebrity chef, basically, as the head chef of our project, which has had such an impact.
Yeah.
So the deal was, when we hired those two chefs, we had a venue lined up. We were going to open a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And then we did the interviews, we hired the chefs, and the venue fell through. The landlord changed his mind. So we hired our two chefs and said to them, right, sorry, you know, a week before they were both due to start, put them down and say, I'm so sorry about this, but our venue has fallen through. Mary Ellen, has been a restaurant owner, has run pop-ups, has worked in a huge range of situations, and said, okay, so we need to find a venue. Yeah. And she said, okay, well, I can think of things we can do in the meantime. You know, we can carry on with the pop-up events. We can just ramp them up. I know lots of restaurants in Manchester where we could, you know, do something that felt a bit more like restaurant service. Mm-hmm. And what we said at the time, we'd gotten some funding to take these chefs on, and we had about 3 months of their wages. Mm-hmm. So we said at the time, so we've got 3 months to find somewhere.
Yeah.
Or to find a way to generate enough income to keep going. I'm blessed them 18 months later. We were still bouncing from one storage space to another and borrowing other people's kitchens. And it's been amazing. In some ways, it's been absolutely brilliant. We have done events that I just never would have imagined. We summer 2016, we went down to Meltdown Festival at the South Bank show, because Guy Garvey was running it. Basically everyone from Manchester got invited. and went as one of the pop-up food traders. We were a guest food trader, outside the South Bank Centre. We have done gala dinners in Grade 2 listed buildings. We did our first wedding last summer, which was amazing.
It makes me want to get married again and come and have a wedding in Manchester just so I can have you.
Do it.
To the same person, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And just, we've done festivals. Just before we opened in August this year, we went to Just So Festival in Cheshire and did a sit-down dinner for 150 people. Wow. In Barn. You know, you just, we've had a hell of an adventure. We've all got absolutely amazing biceps from lifting.
Carrying everything around.
But we were very, very glad when finally, after an 18-month search, Bruntwood Property, I always forget the proper title, but the Bruntwood are property developers mm-hmm. and managers based in Manchester. And they came through with a place smack bang in the middle of the city centre on Oxford Street, just near Oxford Road Station, and basically said, we have development plans for this unit, which means we can't offer it anyone as a, you know, 10, 15 year let, right. Which would be the standard if you wanted someone to spend money and fit things okay. out. But would you guys like it for, you know, anywhere between 3 months and potentially up to 2 years, mm-hmm. depending on how long it takes us to go ahead with our plans?
Right.
And it was just, it's just an absolutely perfect site for wow. us. It's, you know, it almost makes me believe in fate.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't have asked for anything more central. We're one of the busiest footfall areas in Manchester. There's 90,000 people a day walk past the front of our shop.
Yeah.
And it's just getting busier and busier every day. So it's been a bit of an adventure.
Yeah. And I guess it was because I met you in May, I think, didn't I, in Manchester? And you were just, I think, on the brink of kind of signing and you couldn't really say yes. too much. It was just about to happen. And people were saying to you, well, are you not going to have a restaurant? And you were like, yes.
Yes.
But I guess it must be a mix of relief at having a space and not having to lug all that stuff around and being able to move forwards, and sheer terror at the, oh crap, now we're going to make this happen.
Yeah. And it's big. I mean, financially,
yeah,
it's a hell of a thing to do. You know, when it's really hard work running something that's very small where you've got really limited resources, but the risk is really small. You know, yeah. if all you're doing is paying 3 or 4 staff
yeah.
and a little bit of storage and then kind of cobbling together, you know, we really do make do and mend.
Yes.
There's no
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you get into, you know, the site that we're in, Bruntwood, our landlords have been amazing to us. They've given us the site at basically half what the market value mm-hmm. of it is, because we couldn't afford to be there
yeah.
at the rent. But, you know, for a site that big, we've got 60 to 70 covers in the restaurant.
Wow.
We've got an upstairs and a downstairs. So for a site that big, you know, we've got a paid restaurant manager, we've got 2 paid chefs, we've got now, because we're dealing in much more volume, we've got a logistics driver.
Wow.
And you know, we've got 2 paid directors
yeah.
as well. So staff alone
yeah
becomes yeah. a bit terrifying. And then you add in the rent, the water, the rates, the it's a huge beast of an operation. And to kind of take all of that on and just go, we can make this work, right?
Yeah, yeah. And where do you source the waste food from then?
Any food business you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So we work with Ocado. We get all of yep. Ocado returned home shopping deliveries.
Wow.
We work with some wholesalers who things like dried spices, dried herbs, dried pulses. Once things get to their best before date,
yeah.
the wholesalers know that they're perfectly safe and they're perfectly mm-hmm. fine, but retailers will not buy them.
Okay.
Because customers are nervous about buying
yeah.
them. So we work with lots of different food businesses who have different types and quantities of waste for a huge range of different reasons,
yeah.
all of which kind of once you start putting it all together just add up to our food system is yeah. bonkers.
So this food would otherwise, like you said, if it's a returned Ocado order, they literally just have to dump it, do they, otherwise?
Yeah, they were going to waste wow. beforehand. So it's if for whatever reason Ocado give you an hour's window within which they'll deliver, mm. if you're in, if the van is running late, if the van gets stuck in traffic, if the van breaks down, if for whatever reason that delivery doesn't hit, in order to put it back into the food system, what they would have to do is get it back to the Manchester depot, pay someone to sort through it, then send it back to the main depot, which I think is in Huddersfield. I keep saying that, I really need to check. But they've got a big main depot where all of the shopping deliveries for the north of England get picked.
Right.
So they'd sort through it, send it back to the main depot, then they'd have to pay someone to sort through that, put it back on a shelf, and then it could go back into the food system.
And all that time keeping the cold chain and all that kind of thing.
And all that time yeah. keeping it chilled, yeah. And by the time you've done that, items like raw meat, raw fish, milk, cream, you know, they're too close to their date.
Yeah.
It's not even about things getting past their date. If you get a home delivery from Ocado and you've ordered some beautiful steaks and they're on their date, day before, you're probably going to complain.
Mm.
And then there's other items like really low cost items like bags of pasta, bags of rice, tins of beans, loaves of bread. The profit margin on them is
okay.
so high. And staff costs are always the big cost.
Yeah.
Actually, it's completely financially unviable for them to spend the money to sort, pay someone to sort through it all, pay all the diesel for a refrigerated van,
yeah. yeah.
take it all back to wherever it's going,
God.
And then send it out again.
That is bonkers. That is just bonkers, yeah. isn't it? Yeah.
And it's one example of the problem, really, is that food is a business.
Yeah.
It's not about nutrition. It's not about health. It's not about people. It's not about communities. Food is a business. So when we talk about waste food, we're not talking about moldy things. We're not talking about things that have gone off. What we're talking about is at the point that it becomes cheaper to throw it away than it does to put it back into the food system.
Yeah.
That's the point at which food becomes waste. Because food is a business.
And how difficult was it, or it might not have been difficult at all, to get these businesses on board to say, look, we can help you with this? Were they aware that it's, because it's cheaper for them to do that, did they see that as the solution, or were they aware that actually this is a problem, that all this food is going to waste?
I think they're definitely aware. It's been easier with some food businesses, more difficult with others.
Mm-hmm.
Ocado have been brilliant, actually. I do have to credit them. At the end of the day, they run a business.
Yeah.
I'm not juvenile enough or naive enough to sit on the sidelines pointing fingers at what other people aren't doing perfectly and taking pot shots because it gets us nowhere. Ocado are a business, and they have a brand, and they have profit margins and efficiencies that they have to hit. And that's the reality.
Mm.
But they are, they know that this is a bit bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
And B, they know that their customers care. I mean, I'm sure that there are some food businesses who are at an organisational level, you know, the people that are at the top care more or less on, you know, personal or professional level about these issues.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, if your customers care, you care as a business.
Yeah.
And I think there's a number of, it's getting easier to have these conversations because I think food waste as an issue, particularly over the last couple of years, and hopefully in some small part because of what we've done and what lots of other groups who work with food waste and campaigning do, it's definitely getting easier because food waste has more of a public profile and because there have been more programs about food waste.
Yeah.
And food businesses are starting to recognise that if they carry on just sending it to incineration, sending it to anaerobic digestion, sending it to landfill, whatever they're doing with it, at some point people are going to start asking really hard questions.
Yeah. No, and it is just completely bonkers. I'm really aware of time because I know you need to get off. But the pay-as-you-fill model, can you explain that to people who aren't familiar with it? And Is it something that people find uncomfortable?
Pay as you feel means it does exactly what it says on the tin. Customers are invited to sit, enjoy their meal, or if they're having a takeout, which we do for breakfast and lunch, wait till your dish comes up, have a look at it, and then you give whatever you feel. Mm-hmm. And the reason we call it, and we get a lot of people who, I suppose to answer your second question, yes, it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. We're English, we suck at bartering. And we get a lot of people who say, do you have a suggested donation or minimum donation? And we always say, no, it's pay as you feel. It's about the person who comes in. You know, if you ask, take 40 different people and ask them what a fair price for a coffee and a bacon butty is. If you work on a building site and you go to the greasy food van regularly, you might think 150 for a coffee and a bacon butty is what's right. If you spend a lot of time somewhere a bit hipstery, Manchester's North Water, for example, you might think that more like £5.50, £6.50 is right for a bacon butty and a coffee, and you would have very different ideas of what that should include. If you spend time in London, I dread to think what the answer is at the moment, because I try and avoid the place as far as possible. But you know, it is that everybody has a different idea in terms of price about what is the value. And all of those answers are right when it comes to us. And the other thing is it's pay as you feel is about give whatever you think the meal is worth, give whatever you can spare. And if the answer is nothing, that's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And also, get, you know, however you feel about the project, support the project in any way you like. We have people really regularly who come in and have almost, in their own mind, developed their own pay it forward or suspended system with pay as you feel, because they'll have a look at the meal or they'll sit and eat their meal. And then you can kind of see them working it out. There's a sort of, okay, well, I think I'd pay about this much for it, so I'll give twice that much. And then someone else can have a free. And then randomly every now and then we had a guy came in for breakfast. It's probably about a month ago now. And he just, we keep our payment system anonymous. So we have envelopes. If people want to buy cash, they can pay by card, in which case we have to tap something in, but it's entirely up to them. But if people are paying by cash, we just give them a little envelope and just say, you put whatever you want in the envelope and however much you pay is between you and your gods. And this guy handed Tom, our front of house manager, an envelope and just, he'd had breakfast and just said, I just want you to know, I think what you do is amazing. And just walked out. And we looked through the envelopes later that day and it was obvious which was this guy's envelope. He'd left us £30 for breakfast. And that's him paying as he feels. And that, you know, that the hope is that somewhere in amongst all of that, that this balances out and that, you know, we get to stay because some people are having a hard time and they need our support, but some people are doing all right and they can support us.
And so do you find, because we were talking earlier and you were saying you keep a really close eye on your sort of average donation, would you say that it averages out, that the average donation would be kind of what you would expect to pay in a air quotes normal restaurant for a, you know, a 3-course meal or whatever?
Define normal.
But so if you say, you know, you're putting restaurant standard food together and it has a certain aesthetic and a certain feel, and you know, if you were to go to the equivalent restaurant, do you think it roughly evens that out?
I wouldn't comment on it because I wouldn't want anyone to listen to this podcast and feel any sort of the whole point about the model is that any answer is fine, and also that pay as you feel is about more than just money. You know, we get lots of people who donate their time, their energy, their skills. We have a skeleton crew of staff, but we're utterly reliant and endlessly grateful to this amazing army of volunteers that we've amassed. And it's far more important than the money to me is, are people getting involved? And overwhelmingly they are, and that's, you know, that's what will sustain us.
Brilliant. I would imagine that some people, you know, love the idea, would love to do something similar. The pay-as-you-feel thing, does that become a sticking point for people? Because some people would assume that they will end up being taken advantage of. And have you ever found that? Have you ever felt taken advantage of?
No. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Never. And I totally get it. You know, it was a big move for us. Mm. It's scary. It's genuinely scary. Trust is a very scary thing and something we are desperately sure of in this day and age. When we were doing the pop-ups, you know, we started saying, you know, pay as you feel is what's right. Mm-hmm. Adam actually was brilliant. You know, I asked him exactly the same questions when we were just starting out, you know, what pay as you feel, do people take the mic? Is, you know, how does it balance out? And Adam said, and I this comes back to me again and again and again, whenever I get a bit scared about what we're doing, Adam has always said, just do what's right. Whatever happens, just do what you know is right.
Wow.
And we started doing the pop-ups and all the food is pay as you feel. And that was working really well. And then when it was about opening the restaurant, lots of people kind of said to us, well, when you do the pop-ups, because, you know, sometimes people find out about them on social media and book a ticket. So is that maybe your audience coming to you? And are those people more likely to give, you know, we've planted this, the restaurant smack bang in the middle of kind of really busy office district, close to shopping district. So it's in the most mainstream bit you could imagine of Manchester city centre. And a few people did say to us, but they're not going to get it. And what I'm learning is actually if you invite people into a space and offer them the opportunity to be part of it and be lovely humans, absolutely overwhelmingly they get involved.
It's just phenomenal, and it's just, there are so many layers to it, I think, aren't there? And and all of those layers are about, each one of those is about doing it right. And I love these projects where one person's had an idea and had something that they feel really strongly about, possibly hasn't thought it through too strategically in terms of how is this, what is the business model, how am I going to make money, but it's just people get it and it's just grown, and it's just, it's actually the ripples that it's creating and the, you know, the actual real meaningful change it's creating is phenomenal.
I mean, it just is, it's about far more than business. You know, business, economic, I think we forget sometimes that actually economics and business and making money, it's just it's only one small aspect of life. B, it's a fictional system that we created. You know, it doesn't actually exist and now owns us somehow. And what we need a lot more of, if we're going to progress and we're going to be better, is more people just thinking about people and community. And we've said from the start, we will absolutely, unwaveringly, we will stick to our guns. And if this restaurant, or, you know, we have plans for expansion, my co-director and I have started using the term ethical empire.
Wow.
If this restaurant or other aspects of the project don't stack up financially, but we know they're doing good, we'll find other ways to make it work. You know, we can find other ways to, we could be making products, you know, making jams, making chutneys, and that could prop up a project in a really deprived area where we won't make money, it won't work financially, but we know it's needed and we know it'll do good. You know, there's so many different things we could do. We have access to an absolutely amazing resource, beautiful food that should not go to waste. And the mission over the next few years is just A, to do great things with food, and B, to just include as many people as we can.
And I think you've said, you know, we forget in business that it's about more than that. But one of the things that you're doing is you're actually showing people how you can run a financially viable, sustainable business that is sustainable, you know, environmentally, in a, via a community and everything like that. And it just is so heartwarming and encouraging to see and to show people it can be done, you know, and it can be done brilliantly and can be done really well.
I hope so. You know, there's some things that have been really difficult decisions, but that we've kind of come out of it and said, we have to stick to our guns with this. So we are a real living wage employer. And we will always be, because we can't bang on about valuing people and then pay our staff a minimum wage. That definitely doesn't sustain people. all of the disposables that we use are biodegradable, compostable. Yeah. We avoid plastic wherever possible. You know, we make our running costs to a certain extent a bit higher than a lot of other more mainstream businesses, because this, you know, if everyone in the world just did a little bit of this, if every business that set up just said it's not acceptable to say we can't afford to be ethical or we can't afford to be sustainable, then, you know, we'd be a little bit better off, I think.
And it is just that, isn't it? It's just thinking more holistically. And we were talking earlier about you've now got an alcohol license and that you're sourcing all your beer, you know, within a mile or two of where the restaurant is, because it's all local, and that your, you know, your wines are organic and this. And it's just those little tweaks. They don't have to be huge, but it can just more thoughtful about how can we do this more sustainably.
Yeah. And it's been a real journey. You know, the front of house manager that we have and the head chef that we have are both from a business background. You know, we've got an exceptional front of house manager who we're trying to turn into an eco-warrior.
And brainwashing.
Essentially, but in a nice way. it's a real journey. Just that idea that rather than what's the GDP and what's the cheapest option, you know, at the moment, what we've said, while we're all getting to grips with this and we're all learning, is basically buying anything is a policy decision.
Yes.
And we all need to sit down and have a talk about it, the senior team and the directors, about what's the most ethical thing we could do, what's the most sustainable thing we could do. And there's always, you know, that battle between the most sustainable wine we can find is from Chile, but like bringing liquid and glass are really heavy, and transporting them all the way from Chile is reasonable. And you know, there's always you know, Kermit the Frog was right, it's not easy being green. It's a bloody minefield. And we're, you know,
it is a minefield, but if you can keep thinking and you can explain your decisions, you know, you can say, yes, we knew that this wine from Chile was the most ethical, but actually for us the most sustainable option was an organic wine from somewhere in England or from France, or, you know, it's, I think as long as you can explain your rationale and you've thought about it, that's the thing.
And also I think being really open and really honest about the fact that we're trying this, we're trying that, we will make mistakes. And I one of the other things that we're trying to do that I hope is a good model for people is we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to make them really publicly, actually. We're going to talk about things that we've tried that didn't work. And we're going to invite people, you know, our Facebook audience, our Twitter audience, our Instagram audience. We're going to invite people into the process of helping us work this stuff out. We're going to be a community and make decisions in that way in everything we do.
Definitely. And I think that also shows that it's a journey, because I think there's this expectation of people say, almost feel scared to say, I want to have a sustainable business or an ethical business, because you feel like you have to go from where you are now to like this nirvana of whatever it is that probably doesn't even exist. And it's showing that it's just a journey, and you just need to start taking the first steps and thinking about what's next.
Yeah. And I think it's a pedestal that opens you up to pot shop. And what we, you know, that I said about Ocado earlier, we've no interest in sitting on the sidelines taking pot shots at big businesses saying you should do this, you're not doing that, because it's utterly unconstructive. I also have very little tolerance and absolutely no time and respect for people who get a bit troll-esque on our social media page and go, why aren't you doing this? Because as a general rule, they're people who are doing sack all themselves in their own life. You know, it's really easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize. As someone who's been in this for more than 3 years now, I can confirm that it's absolutely terrifying to be in it and doing it, and particularly the founder and the figurehead of it. But, you know, we'll continue to do it, and we'll continue to be utterly imperfect in our attempts at doing it, and we'll make absolutely no apologies for that.
Oh, Corinne, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but I know you've got to get off, and we've already gone over time. Thank you so, so much for sharing this, and I just think it's so inspiring for people, and whatever, you know, niche or sector their business is, there's so much I think that people can take away from this. So it's been fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Making Good podcast with me, Jen Gale. If you've enjoyed the show, I'd really love you to pop over to iTunes to leave a review and say nice things. I'd also love to hear your feedback and your thoughts, so do drop me a line on jen@jengale.co.uk or head over to my Making Good community on Facebook. Thanks for listening.